Great. Okay. All right. You can hear me now. Yes. See, nobody's screens are on, so I can't get like a thumbs up. Can anybody do like an emoji, you know, icon thumbs up? Yeah. Let me know that. Okay. Oh, awesome. Great. Wonderful. Okay, Rivka, you're still at the shul. Amazing. Thank you. Many, many thanks. Okay, great. So let's get going. Okay, again, thank you to everybody. Again, you didn't hear me the first time around, but thank you to everyone. Thank you to everyone for making the time. I know it's very, very busy. We've been busy with very important things, and I wasn't sure that even doing this year necessarily made sense. But I appreciate the turnout. I appreciate everybody hopping on for a call. We do spend a lot of time in some very, very important ways, preparing for Pesach. It's all critical. It's all halachic. It's all necessary. It's all part of what it means to get ready for the Chag. But it can get a little bit drab, meaning to say that we can get so caught up in just cooking for cooking's sake and cleaning for cleaning's sake if we don't spend a little bit of time pulling back and considering some of the important conversations we should be having with ourselves, some of the important conversations we should be having with others, certainly with people who are going to be seated around our Seder tables. We can really lose sight of what Pesach is supposed to be about. From a hashkafic vantage point, the kinds of messages and ideas and ideals and values that we're supposed to be trying to imbibe in this very, very important time. So with that, let me get started. And let me just give a little bit of backdrop as to what I would like to try to accomplish here this evening. What I would like to do is as follows. And I mentioned this in shul earlier this evening, and a couple of people who had asked me what tonight's shir was really supposed to be about. What does conversations of consequence actually mean? And what it means is as follows. I think that oftentimes when we are at a Seder, and even if we're leading a Seder, I know that I've been there myself, I feel that sometimes I can get like lost in Vartlach. I can get lost in, here's an idea, and here's a thought, and here's a this, and here are that, and we're at this paragraph, and here's something that somebody says, and here's a little idea at the bottom of the Haggadah, and let me read it, and I'll kind of try to understand it even as I'm reading it. And it's all good. It's all Torah. It's all Talmud Torah. You can make a Birkas HaTorah beforehand. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. However, I think that there are some really, really basic themes and ideas and concepts that this is the night to really discuss, and this is the night to really digest. It's the night to impart these messages both to children and also anybody who might be sitting around the table. And it's also a night to absorb these messages ourselves. And what I would like to do, rather than just speaking about fragmented individual ideas, here's a Vart, here's a Dvart Torah, here's a nice thing, here's the, you know, like the equivalent of you know, it's beautiful, but what kids, you know, usually bring home, you know, in terms of their Haggadahs. Look, I have an idea on Karpas, and I have an idea on, you know, on the Seder in Bnei Brak, and they share them. But they don't necessarily have anything to do with one another. There's no overarching theme that we're really trying to just hammer away. That's what I want to try to do tonight, both for its own sake, but also as a means of trying to prepare all of us for the Seder. So what I have are five overarching conversations that I really think could be run through almost the entirety of the Seder night. And I'll leave them with you. What I would like to do is discuss each theme just in concept. What are we talking about? What is the takeaway? What's the message? What's the idea that we can be trying to that we can try to think about ourselves and also have conversations about on the Seder night? And then I'll try to give you a series of points in the Seder where I think these can really be pointed to, and where we can continue the conversation. So meaning to say that there are a number of points for each one of these themes throughout the Seder that can serve as almost hieroglyphs or touch points for each one of these ideas. So if we're having this conversation, you can bring it up again and again at the Seder, let's say four or five times over, each from a slightly different angle at different points, and hopefully not just not really make it a monologue in terms of whoever is leading the Seder, whoever is sharing the idea, but hopefully some either instruction or ideas. Some hacks to be able to really open the conversation and have it be something that other people will hopefully participate in as well. Okay, so let's get started. Here is theme number one. And let me just pull up so that we can get there if we need to. Our good friends at Safaria. Everybody should, while you're also, you know, going online and making donations for Maos Chitim, you can also throw some money to Safaria, because either you use it a lot or you should be using it a lot. It's really a wonderful resource. Okay, so here we have at least started with Magen. We could bounce around in the text of the Seder should we have the need. Theme number one, conversation number one, freedom from ourselves. The Seder night obviously is about freedom. It's the night that HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought us free. It's the night that we went from avdus to cheros, from subjugation to redemption. That's something that I don't think necessarily resonates quite as much, at least in this generation. Baruch Hashem for that. It does in the sense that, yes, of course, we know our history, and this is a night, and we'll talk about this in a little bit. It's about trying to tie ourselves back into history. So yes, being very appreciative for the reality that we don't have any external oppressors. But I think that there is another dimension of freedom that is worth our while, and that's talking about freedom from ourselves. Not the external oppression, but some of those internal impulses, the internal compulsions that we all struggle with, that we all suffer from, that internal sort of tension that we try to break free from, that we try to transcend, that we try to overcome. I think this is a great conversation. I think all these are great conversations to be able to have with kids. They're great conversations to be able to have with adults as well. Have we ever found ourselves? You could throw these out as questions. Have we ever found ourselves in a scenario in which, even though we really wanted to do something, we felt somehow or another shackled? We felt somehow or another enslaved, incapable of actually doing whatever it was that we set out to do. And not because necessarily our talents failed us, not because we found ourselves literally not good enough or not capable enough, but I just couldn't bring myself to. I wasn't organized enough. I wasn't motivated enough. I wasn't proactive enough. Have we ever found that laziness or bad habits have placed handcuffs around our wrists? Not unlike the way it feels, not unlike there was some sort of external oppressor or external force that was holding us back. Have we ever wanted to be better in school? And even though we told ourselves that we would, and even though we told ourselves that this is going to be the test that I really succeed, this is going to be the year where I finally do well in all my classes, and we push for a little bit, and then, I don't know, somehow or another, it falls apart. And not because we're really dumb or we're not bright enough, but just I couldn't motivate myself for long enough. Have I ever wanted to be more kind? Have I ever wanted to be more patient? Have I ever wanted to really hold myself back from saying that? Because I know that when I've said those things, it offends people, or people look at me funny, or they don't want to hang out with me anymore, or I just know that it's not nice, or I know that it's insulting, and I've really wanted to hold myself back, and I just wasn't able to. I felt like I was almost forced. I was forced, like there was a taskmaster whipping me, forcing me into a position that I just didn't want to be in. It's not just my own, fluffy idea. The fact of the matter is that speaking about the luchos that were engraved, that were etched, the etzba Elokim, with the finger of Hashem, Chazal tell us, al tikrei charus, don't read it as charus, ches, resh, vav, sav, which means engraved or etched, but rather tikrei cherus, read it as freedom. We recognize that when we have certain rules, when we have certain ambitions, and when we have responsibilities that we're supposed to fulfill and uphold, that can actually lead to freedom. I really want to be able to, whatever it is, study for the test, or turn in that assignment on time, or do well by my superiors at work, or make good on the promise that I made to a friend or to a family member or a colleague. I really want to, but I can't necessarily drive myself or motivate myself. But the fact that I have the rule, or the fact that I'm forced, or the fact that I said that I was going to, now I'll really follow through. Sometimes responsibility actually, it's not something that hinders freedom, but actually generates freedom, or it motivates freedom, because it pushes us to a place that we ultimately want to be in anyway. There's the connection, of course. This is certainly something to talk about the second night, once we've already started counting Sfiras HaOmer, the connection that exists between Pesach and Shavuos, that we go directly from Pesach, Sfiras HaOmer, we start counting up towards Shavuos, up towards Matan Torah, because of the reality and because of the recognition that we cannot celebrate physical freedom on its own. Physical freedom is worthwhile only when we have responsibility, only when we have a framework in which we can operate that allows us to achieve things that we really have ambition to achieve. We want to be holy. We want to be spiritual. We want to be pure. If left to our own devices, then maybe we couldn't motivate ourselves to do so. So I think those are really, really important touch points, but also really important questions that can be thrown out around the table. And I'll speak about some specific times during the Seder. But Have we ever found that we wanted to achieve something but couldn't? Have we ever found that the fact that we were forced actually put us in a position where we did achieve what we really wanted to achieve anyway? And what does that make us think about what freedom really is? Is freedom necessarily an absence of rules? You don't have rules, you can do whatever you want, it's total anarchy. Or when we really don't have any rules, sometimes we don't necessarily feel so great about ourselves. Have you ever been at a point when you've been on vacation, kids and adults, where you've been on vacation, you thought it was going to be great and wonderful and amazing, and then you find yourself, you're just like, you're feeling just bored and slothful and just icky, like you don't have anything to do, you don't have anything important. And as much as maybe we feel kind of like tired and bored sometimes, either in school or at work or when we're fulfilling other responsibilities, and yet the fact that the responsibility is there, it motivates us and it drives us to actually feel really, really good about ourselves. What are some of our greatest achievements? When did we feel best about ourselves? Was it when there was an absence of rules, an absence of responsibilities, or specifically when there were many responsibilities? So I think, again, it's an ongoing running theme throughout the Seder. Where would we run it through? So what are some of those touch points? You can speak about this, I think, at Karpas. Karpas, there's actually halacha with respect to Karpas that is a really, really interesting point to be made here in this context. Karpas, how much do we eat of Karpas? Chatzi kezayas, less than a kezayas. Why? Why not have a whole kezayas? It's late at night. We've been waiting. We're all hungry. We don't want to be able to eat. So why not enjoy and why not take part? So the answer is because, sorry, I'm losing my maggot here. So the answer is the reason why we don't is because we don't want to be in position to perhaps need to make a bracha achrona. If you eat a kezayis, then you might have to make a bracha achrona immediately thereafter. This all relates to whether or not magid is really a hefsek. Is it an interruption between karpas and maror? When we make the borei pri hadama at karpas, we think that maybe that borei pri hadama is going to be necessary for maror also. We want it to last, so to speak, until maror. But the truth of the matter is, maybe if we eat a full kezayis of karpas, we'll have to immediately make a borei nefashos, and then the borei pri hadama that we made on the celery isn't going to last for the maror. That's a very intense, very involved kind of cheshbon calculation that we make about just having a snack. Who does that? What kind of people do that? People who are really bound by a lot of responsibility. What should just be a snack, what should require no more thought process than just, I'm hungry, there's food, I wish to eat, I'm going to eat. You say, stop, I have to think, I have to consider, what is my responsibility towards halacha? What's my responsibility towards this bracha that I'm supposed to make to thanking Hashem? And we enter into this entire intellectual calculation when really we should just be motivated by our stomachs. Why? We begin the night, when we think about what cheiros is, we actually exercise. We exercise that cheiros. I can be free for myself. I can overcome my compulsion. I can overcome my own impulse. I can be better than I would be if just left to my own devices when I have a certain measure of responsibility that motivates me to do so. Halach ma'anya. Here it is. Here's the paragraph. Halach ma'anya. At the very beginning, of course, we say, kol dich v'yesev yechol, kol ditzrich yesev yevsach. You have needs? Come in. I'm ready. I'm willing to take care of you. We think beyond ourselves. We transcend ourselves because we have, in part, because we have a mandate to take care of one another. Because kol Yisrael ha'ravim zeh bazeh, because we're responsible for one another. We must be responsible for one another. There's a social contract that exists between all of Klal Yisrael. We must take care of one another. And sometimes, yes, it's ideal if we were just pure-hearted and motivated to take care of one another all the time. But the fact of the matter is, sometimes it comes down to just a responsibility. Even if I don't necessarily feel like it, I don't feel like sharing my food. I want my food myself. I want to eat my food myself. I don't want to have to share with anybody else. But the fact of the matter is, I do it. I can think beyond myself. I can transcend. That is a true mark of cheiros, when we're able to overcome and transcend our own impulses. Her salvation made a beautiful point, actually, right in advance of Halach Ma'anya about yachatz. So when we break the middle matzah, we put half of it away because we say we're going to save it later. We're going to save it for later because that is the way of an ani. Doesn't know when his next meal is coming, and therefore he has to make sure that whatever he has in stock now, part of it is saved for later, for the next meal, for tomorrow. Soloveitchik suggested that maybe we're not just saving it for ourselves, but this notion, as we're going to say in the very, very next paragraph about how we invite everybody else to come and eat, maybe that's what we're doing at Yachatz. The reason why we break it is because we say, what do I need for this Uda? What do I really need for this meal? For this meal, for right now, I'm good with just having a half. Maybe there's somebody else out there. Maybe somebody else out there actually needs another half. By the way, tie this in maybe in something of a a little bit of a warped kind of way, but I was thinking about that idea from Rav Soloveitchik in the context of what happens with that matzah. Where does that matzah actually go? Get stolen by other people. It gets picked up by the kids. So in a way, when we break the matzah and we tuck it away, we're actually providing for other people when we do so. Maybe it's not just keeping it aside for ourselves, but it's keeping it aside for the possibility that maybe somebody else might actually need it more than I really do. Another idea, again, from something of a different angle, for all you romaine lettuce eaters out there, for all those who don't use horseradish, or if you use romaine lettuce in addition, one of the basic questions on romaine lettuce, it's asked in the Gemara, how does romaine lettuce pass as maror? It's not bitter. It's not bitter. I mean, it's not nearly as harsh as horseradish, that's for sure, but it's not really bitter. Is it bitter? Not exactly bitter. The answer is it's not bitter because we harvest it prematurely, or we harvest it when it's ripe. But if you allow it to stay in the ground for longer, it does develop more and more and more of a bitter taste. We've never had it because obviously romaine lettuce farmers harvest it when it's going to be rather sweet and enjoyable and ready for the commercial market. It's an interesting idea to think about, that the longer entrenched something becomes, the more bitter it becomes. If we think about this from the vantage point of our own freedom, personal freedom just from ourselves, our ability to overcome, to transcend our own bad habits and our own impulses, think about how the longer something remains, the more difficult it then is to overcome. What we want to try to do is weed out those bad habits in our youth. This is a great point to make when it comes to the kids. The fact of the matter is, if everybody's open to it and you have the right kind of crowd, this can actually be a really interesting dialogue between the older generations and the younger generations right there at the Seder table, where the younger generations might be able to speak about something that they want to work on and they wish that they could do. And somebody from the older generation telling you, work on that now. Here's what I've been struggling with my whole life. Here's what I just can't quite kick. I'm for 60 years, I've been late to shul. For 60 years, I hit my snooze, you know, three times before I wake up in the morning. For 60 years, whatever it is, I'm addicted to smoking, whatever it is. You know, I have something that I wish that I could transcend. I wish that I could get past, and I can't. And the earlier you can start that process, the better, because the longer it stays in the ground, the more bitter it is. The longer it stays entrenched, remains entrenched, the more difficult it is to actually then uproot it and actually overcome. Just one other idea. You know, we say mitchila ovdei avodah zarah hayu avoseinu. At some point, and we'll come back to this, but at some point we talk about not only what happened in Mitzrayim, but we talk about our own history well before Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. We speak about how once upon a time we were idol worshippers. So what in the world is that doing at the Seder? I thought we were talking about overcoming Paro, overcoming the Mitzrayim, overcoming slavery, how HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us out of physical bondage. Why would we be talking about how, you know, once upon a time, you know what we were, you know what we were about, you know what we did? Because there is this very personal, spiritual, personal component to this entire conversation. It's not only about how we were enslaved by an external force, but also just an internal force. We ennobled ourselves. We were beset by polytheism. We didn't yet adopt ethical monotheism. And yet, over the course of the generations, a lot of hard work from Avram Avinu and a lot of hard work from the Avos and Imahos and the subsequent generations, this is part of what we consider on this night. Not only a physical transformation of a slave people into a free people, but a person, an individual, even, yes, as an entire nation, but who are beset by our own warped ideas, our own mentalities that need to be changed and need to be transformed. And it's a success story. It's a story about how we've actually been able to overcome, how we've actually been able to do that, how we've been able to change spiritually, change mentally, change our perspectives, change our ideologies. This is something that very much we can and should take note of on the Seder night as a parallel to the physical freedom that we also enjoy. Conversation number one. Conversation number two. Okay, let's keep going here. And again, I'm going to be bouncing back and forth throughout the Haggadah. These are just different ideas, different suggestions of things that you could really work your way through the entirety of Maggid or the entirety of the Seder and touch on these themes at different points. So let's talk about Geula being attitude dependent. That Geula is not as binary as either you're in or you're out. You're either enslaved or you're redeemed. You're either oppressed or you're liberated. what we find again and again throughout the Haggadah is, first of all, not only does it not really move in a straight line, not only is it not just, okay, you begin the Haggadah and you begin the Seder night, and when we begin the Seder night, we make a point of, you know, we were slaves. And then at some point, there's this great transition, this great transformation. Now we talk about what it was like to be free. We go back and forth throughout. Not only do we go back and forth throughout, but there are even certain moments in the Seder when both are present at the exact same time. At the exact same moment, we take note simultaneously of being both free and also being slave. The suggestion is that it's not as simple as Hashem saying, okay, poof, now you're free, and therefore you're free. Objectively, you're free. That's it. Zero-sum game. I'm either oppressed or I'm free. So much is dependent upon our mentality. How do we view it? How do we view things? Do we view things with rosy glasses? Do we view things with optimism? Do we view things through the prism of gratitude, being thankful for what we do have, even though it's not ideal, and even though it's not that there isn't so much more that we also want? Or do we view things with pessimism? Do we say, oh, it could be better, this is there, that was done, I still want this, and I still want that, and this was supposed to happen, that was supposed to happen? What an important theme to discuss specifically this year. Even if things are not quite exactly as great as we would want, and even if it's true that we still have plastic barriers wherever we go, and we still have masks, and we're still doing social distancing, et cetera, think about the position we're in this year compared to last year. The numbers, the rate of the death rate and rate of infection, certainly Baruch Hashem, at least in this country, and certainly in Eretz Yisrael, have gone down tremendously. There's so much to be thankful for if we choose to be thankful. But we could take the exact same stimulus and we could look at it through a prism of negativity and pessimism, and we can say that what's there to be thankful for, I still wish and I still hope for so much more. So these are the kinds of questions that we can pose. How do we view this year? Let's think about coronavirus. Let's think about the pandemic. Are we better off than we were last year? Do we take stock of that on a daily basis? Or does it just become we become so habituated to our present environment that we forget how much there is to be thankful for? Even at the very beginning of the pandemic, were there things that we always took for granted, never even thought to be thankful for? Whoever thought to be thankful for a handshake? Whoever thought to be thankful for a hug? Whoever thought to be thankful to be able to read somebody's lips as they were speaking to you instead of just trying to make out the sound? Whoever thought of being thankful just for a normal davening and an indoor davening and a normal kiddush and a normal dinner and a normal barbecue and a normal get-together, whoever thought to be thankful for these things? So we could either look them over, we could look beyond them, and we could be cold to the gratitude that we owe to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and others for them, or we could remind ourselves to be grateful. So where do we see this kind of notion all throughout the Seder? So many different places. Consider the wine. We begin with Kaddish. Kaddish. We start with the wine. And the wine is obviously a reference to Geula. We know the four cups of wine were instituted because of the four Lishonos of Geula, or four Geulos, different ways of putting it. So we drink the first cup of wine. We're already thinking, Hotseisi, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you took us out of Mitzrayim. We're told, the Shulchan Aruch notes that we're supposed to have, the Gemara in Pesachim already tells us that we're supposed to have red wine. One of the reasons why they say that we have red wine is because it's supposed to be a Zecher Ladam. Zecher Ladam, commemoration of the blood, doesn't mean a commemoration of the blood of Makas Dam, of the plague, but rather it's the Dam of the infanticide. It's the blood that was spilled, the blood of the Jewish children that was spilled by Paro and his henchmen. So there's Geula, and at the same time, there is this real negative sort of tone. We also drink it while we recline. What's the story with the wine? What is the wine? Is wine a symbol of freedom? Is it a symbol of slavery? Which is it supposed to be? The reality is that it's both. Now, absolutely, it goes without saying, I don't mean to say that there's no point in ever hoping for true geula, because after all, geula is just a state of mind. I don't mean to say that. But what I do mean to say is that even when things are negative, and even in the real depths of what was Shibud Mitzrayim, there are still elements to be positive about, and there are still elements to be optimistic about. There are still elements to give gratitude for. So what's the wine? The reality is that the wine is both. The wine simultaneously, like so many things. What do you focus on? What do you consider it? What are you going to harp on? Are you going to harp on the fact that there is death and destruction? Or are you going to harp on the fact that Hashem gave a promise, that Hotzesi, that I'm going to take them out? Is it worth reclining over? Is it not worth reclining over? Something that I only thought about this year. You know, when it comes to pouring the wine, we make a point to say, somebody else pour. I'm not going to pour my wine. Everybody pours for somebody else. Why does everybody else pour for somebody else? Because I shouldn't have to pour my own glass of wine. Ben Melech, I'm kingly and I'm princely and I'm noble and I'm regal and I'm royal and I have all of my servants around the table who can take care of all of my bidding for me. They can pour my wine. What does that mean? What does that mean? If I have all my servants around the table who can pour my wine for me, it means that in that moment, while I'm experiencing cheras, while I'm experiencing freedom, it means that the person right next to me is playing the part of Eved. At the exact same moment, while we are enjoying simultaneously, we're enjoying a symbol of cheras and of freedom, we're also recognizing a symbol of avdus, of shibud, of servitude. So which is it going to be? What are you going to harp on and what are you going to focus on? I think so many of these elements throughout the Seder have, there's this innate dialectic to so many of the different icons of the Seder specifically for this purpose. Karpas is fresh and it's spring and it's the first thing that we get to eat. And what do? We dip it in salt water because that's supposed to be representative of the tears. And then what do? We eat it, behasebo, we recline again. You recline. Well, what is it? What's the karpas? Is it good? Is it bad? Is it something to bemoan? Is it something to celebrate? What about charoses? So what is charoses? Charoses is zecher letit. Charoses is supposed to be commemorative of the mortar, of the mortar. This was the symbol of the oppression. And what's everybody's favorite food on the table? Charoses. What do I have to remind everybody around the table? Everybody around the table and everybody in shul, I'm the Grinch who stole Pesach. To remind everybody every year, once you dip the maror, shake off all the charoses, because if you don't shake off the charoses, you're not really yotzei the mitzvah of maror, because maror has to be tam maror, has to taste bitter. Everybody's slathering on the charoses. Oh, more charoses, so delicious. So delicious. What in the world? Why do we concoct this recipe that's so sweet? People can't get enough of it. Why is it that we add tapuchim? Let's just assume for a moment that tapuchim indeed are apples. So we use apples in our charoses. Why do we use apples? We use apples because based on the Gemara in Sota, the Gemara says, the Agadata and the Gemara there talks about how when the women were going to give birth, they didn't want to give their birth directly into the hands of Paro's mercenaries and have their babies snatched and then thrown into the river. So instead, they went to the apple orchards. Again, as they were apple, the apples growing in Mitzrayim, just tapuachim, I mean, an apple, maybe mean something else, some kind of citrus or whatever it was, these groves. They went to these groves, and there's a reference made in Shir HaShirim to all of this. So they went and that's where they gave birth and the children were miraculously saved by Malachim and everything was okay. So we have that element right there in that which is supposed to serve as the symbol of the servitude. What is it? Is the servitude sweet? Is the servitude bitter? The reality is that even in the midst and in the depths of servitude, we can see the Yad Hashem. We can recognize that it could always be worse. We could see that Hashem cares. We could see the silver lining. We could appreciate the small miracles that are taking place or even the enormous miracles if we'll only just open our eyes to them. Again, what gets dipped into this very sweet and delicious charoses is the maror, is the epitome of the bitterness. Dayenu, all throughout Dayenu. Dayenu, we note that every single stage, on the one hand, is worth giving thanks and saying praise. What could you also do at every single stage? You could say, we're only a part of the way there. It's everybody's kasher. I don't understand. What do you mean? If we only got out and we only got to the midbar and then Kadosh Baruch Hu, you just left us there to die, Dayenu, that would have been good enough. Puts the die back in Dayenu. What do you mean if we just came to Har Sinai and we never got the Torah? What do you mean if we only had this and we never had that? Dayenu? Yeah, because the reality is we still would have been better off in that phase than we would have been in the phase before. We would have seen Hashem's love. We would have felt his embrace. We would have felt his arm around our shoulders. How do we view it? Do we view it as, oh, there's so much more that we still need. We still aren't in Eretz Yisrael. We still aren't at Har Sinai. Or do we say that right now we can stop, we can pause, we can celebrate? Matzah zu sha'anu ochlim. When we speak about matzah, there's a little bit more involved, but matzah, without going through this in the actual text, But when we get to matzah, to that point of the Seder, why do we say that we eat matzah? So we eat matzah because matzah zoo. Let me scroll down here. here. Here we go. Pesach matzah zushanu ochel mal shum matzah. Why do we eat the matzah? So here we say, al shum shalu hispik b'tzeikam shalav usim l'hachmitzah chenigla aleyam melech malchei amalachim HaKadosh Baruch Hu uge alam. Because Hashem redeemed us so quickly, we didn't have time to let the matzah rise. The matzah is a symbol of freedom. When we say halach ma'anya, some interpret that halach ma'anya is a paragraph that would have been said by the people that first night in Mitzrayim. That first night in Mitzrayim, before they left that very first Seder, they'd be saying, halach ma'anya diachalu avahasana ba'arad Mitzrayim. This is the bread of affliction that we've always eaten. We ate and our parents ate and our grandparents ate here in Mitzrayim. Why? Because it's literally the bread of affliction. This is the kind of bread you eat when you don't have time to allow things to rise because you're being hurried. You're being hurried back to servitude. You can't just lay in a hammock while your dough rises. You have a taskmaster waiting at the door. So you have to eat quickly. You don't have time to let it rise. And then suddenly, v'nahafachu, it also becomes a symbol of redemption. The exact same symbol. The exact same symbol. What do we make of matzah? What is matzah? Do we just harp on the fact that this was once upon a time something that we ate in a state of servitude? Or do we realize, no, because it's not because we didn't have time. We didn't have time to be free because we were too busy being slaves. No, it's also the matzah that we ate because we didn't have time to be slaves anymore. We had to hurry and rush out in order to be free. So often in life, there are elements and there are situations, there are scenarios, there are things that take place, and there are items even that we can view either positively or negatively. You got me this. It wasn't exactly what I wanted. So do I harp on the fact that it's not exactly what I wanted, or that, oh, this is pretty good. That's not the dinner that I wasn't expecting. That I can't believe this. Or we get there, and the one thing that I like to order on the menu, I can't believe they don't have, the evening's ruined, the night is over, or my steak is overdone. Eating a steak, it's a nice night out. I'm enjoying myself. It's all fine. It's all good. Is it exactly the way that I wanted it? Maybe not, but that nevertheless, we can create geula around us to no small degree based on our attitude. Even when we are out in the midbar, we could say, what was the point? Why did we get out here? Why did we come all this way? Why did we come all this way for nothing? Where we can say, Baruch Hashem, we got out. Yaakov, you have a question? Yaakov, go ahead.
Now, I unmuted by mistake. Go ahead.
You raised your hand. Was that a mistake?
It was a mistake.
Okay, I'll just assume it's a high five, okay?
You got it.
All right, great. Okay, fine. Bye there. Okay, conversation number three, such a critical one. I really try to talk about this at least to no small degree every year, and that's Hashem's hand in history. Seder night is about remembering and recognizing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't just once upon a time create the world, but that he's active, that Hashem has a plan, there's scope and sequence, Hashem has an ambition, Hashem has an aim, he has an objective, and he's going to lead all of humanity, all of society, all of history towards that eventuality. The Ramban in a couple of places, actually in his commentary on Chumash, says that this is why, by the way, on Shabbos, we say Zecher L'Tzias Mitzrayim. What does Shabbos have to do with Yitzias Mitzrayim? Well, Shabbos is really twofold. We say that it's Zecher L'Maaseh Bereishis, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world. He created the world in 6 days. He rested on the seventh day. So we mimic that behavior, and it's a nod to the fact that that's what Hashem did. But also Zecher L'Tzias Mitzrayim. Why should I keep Shabbos today? Because Hashem created the world all the way back then. What if you just, you know, the watchmaker theory, like you set the clock and then that's it, and then he took off and goodbye. What does that have to do with me today? What Yitzias Mitzrayim proved was that Hashem plays an active role in history, that Hashem is still interested, that Hashem is still involved, that Hashem still has his fingers in everything that goes on, even in history, not only as it once was, but as it is presently and as it will continue to be in the future. Zecher Litzias Mitzrayim, I stop now because I recognize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is still a force. I don't have to work today because even if I take off, everything will still be okay because Hashem is still that guiding light. We see it throughout the Seder. And you can speak about this anywhere because it's the reality of what we do, of what the Seder night is. I think this is probably one of the more basic of any of these themes, that Hashem runs the world and Hashem took us out and Hashem took care and there were all the details worked out and planned out and every single makkah perfectly calibrated and everything's just done in such a fashion so that we will get out at the exact time, the exact place, everything works out so perfectly. It's this reminder, this powerful reminder that Hashem didn't only once upon a time, but Hashem currently, actively, every single moment, every single day, every single generation. So a couple of points, a couple of places where, I don't know, you see maybe a more interesting angle. Let's go back to Avadim Hayinu for one moment. So the kids ask Manishtana, good. Avadim Hayinu l'far ben Mitzrayim. I always thought this was a fascinating point. Ve'yotzi'enu Hashem elokeinu misham b'yad chazaka v'zeranitiyah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu took us out of Mitzrayim. Ve'ilu lo hotzi HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We think about this. Ve'ilu lo hotzi HaKadosh Baruch Hu esavoseinu mimitzrayim. If Hashem hadn't taken out our forefathers, hari anu, uvanenu, uvnei vanenu, we and our children, our grandchildren, still mishubadim hayinu l'far ben Mitzrayim. They would still be mishubad. They would still be enslaved to Pyro today. Give me a break. Not true. Empires rise and empires fall. There's a natural ebb and flow to history. It wouldn't have been Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim would not still have been there. Our children, they would have gotten out by some natural means at some point, even if Hashem didn't intervene. This seems to say otherwise. This suggests otherwise, that we are making a mistake when we view history exclusively through those natural glasses and see that there's a natural order, there's an ebb and flow, there's a natural rising tide and then receding tide to history. It's just how things go, empires this way and empires that way, and leading figures and politicians and presidents and kings. The reality is that Hashem has an objective. He has an aim. There is a purpose to all of history, and he is guiding us towards that point. You know why empires fall? Because at some point, it's time to move on in order to inch ever closer to the terminus of history, wherever it is that Hashem is guiding us towards. Had Hashem not decided, it's true, had Hashem not brought 10 Makos, then there would have been a very different reality than we actually experienced. But it's not to say that Mitzrayim would have just naturally evaporated all on its own. Mitzrayim goes away because Hashem says it's time to go away. Hashem is an active force in history. Not only is Hashem an active force in history that he can manipulate and alter the natural order, but that moreover, there is no natural order. Things don't just happen on their own unless Hashem decides otherwise. Being an active force means that things continue along their trajectory only so long as HaKadosh Baruch Hu still continues to will it. We should look at history. We should try to understand things through, you know, historical lenses and through historical phenomena. It's all important. It's part of our hishtablus, but there has to be this very, very clear and underlying sense that ultimately it's about what HaKadosh Baruch Hu does. He's in control. He makes these decisions. That doesn't mean that absolves us from our activity. It means that we can only succeed or only achieve at doing anything if Hashem wills it as well. Another area. Where else can we see this? Yachol Merosh Chodesh. Yachol Merosh Chodesh. So you would have thought that maybe we should start Sipri Tzias Mitzrayim from Rosh Chodesh. Sorry. Let me scroll back up here. Avadim Hayinu. Here we go. Sorry. Here we go. Yachol Merosh Chodesh, right? So you would have thought that maybe we should start this, or maybe we should fulfill this mitzvah, perform this mitzvah from Rosh Chodesh, from the very first of the month. Why would we think so? Why would we think that would be an appropriate time to do so? So the Brisker Rav says something fabulous here. Brisker Rav says, you know, I would have thought that Rosh Chodesh Nisan is the time for Sipri Tzias Mitzrayim when we start to fulfill this mitzvah. What happened on Rosh Chodesh Nisan? On Rosh Chodesh Nisan, HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't take us out, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised that we would go out. Oh, take it to the bank. Money in the bank. If Hashem promises that we're going to go out, that night when Hashem had a conversation with Moshe Rabbeinu, and he tells him about Kiddush HaChodesh, and he says, HaChodesh HaZelechem, and he also promises him, he says, you're going to see 5 days, I want you to take the karbon now, take the sen now, you're going to have to check and make sure that it's ready to be brought as a karbon. It's going to be that night, I'm going to pass through Mitzrayim, I'm going to kill all the firstborns, that's the night you're going to be leaving, it's going to be Geula. From the moment HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises, that's it, it's money in the bank. Hashem is an active force in history. When Hashem promises that something will take place, it will absolutely take place, and we can be so certain of it that we'd even have a havamina to start talking about it as though it already happened, even though it hadn't yet. Think about the last Gemara in Makos, where Akiva Rabbi Akiva is at the is up on Har HaBayis with his colleagues, and they see the fox run across Har HaBayis. Everybody starts crying, and he starts giggling. He thinks it's great. He thinks it's beautiful. What a wonderful sight. Rabbi Akiva, what are you out of your mind? This is terrible. This is the place of the Churban Beis HaMikdash. He says, no. There is a prophecy that it would be destroyed. There's a prophecy that it'll be rebuilt, and that'll be the Geula Shlema. If the first part of the prophecy was fulfilled, then the second part of the prophecy is also going to be fulfilled. This is glorious. This is incredible. This means that it's all happening. Rabbi Akiva was able to see what was coming round the bend, even though it hadn't happened yet, purely because HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised it. And what do they say? Akiva Nechamtanu. Akiva Nechamtanu. We speak about how Bechol Dor Vador. I'm sorry. No, I'm skipping here. Okay. Let's move on to conversation number four. Okay. Again, I think this is something that you can really weave through the entirety of the Seder idea that Hashem is an active force in history. We see it all over the place when we speak about the Makos and everything that he did and everything that he was involved in. Biyad Chazaka, that it was as though we actually saw his arm and his finger, as though he was almost tangible. That's how clear an impression HaKadosh Baruch Hu made as he was taking us out of Mitzrayim. Okay. Let's talk about conversation number four. Conversation number four is Mesorah. Mesorah, which the way that Rav Soloveitchik spoke about Mesorah is really the collapsing of generations. Beautiful, beautiful depiction that Rav Soloveitchik gave of his own shiur, that when he would come into shiur and he would start learning, suddenly, you know, the Rambam would come and he would walk in and he would sit down and he would sit in the back as soon as he mentions the Rambam. Then the Ravid walks in and he comes in and he sits down at a desk in the back, at a seat in the back. And then afterwards, his grandfather, Reb Chaim, would come in. All the personalities that he would quote and he would mention, he would speak of in such familiar terms. This is the process of learning. You feel like you get to know. You feel like you have a relationship with the Rambam. You feel like you have a relationship with the Ravid. You feel like you have a relationship even with your grandfather, great-grandfather who might not be alive anymore, because you continue to speak his Torah, to remember his sayings, to remind yourself of their personalities. You can become close and enjoy a close relationship even with people you've never met before, people who may have died centuries ago, because you learn from them and because we study their words and because we live our lives so similarly to the way that they live their lives. I think it's a really important thing to take stock of. And this is a great conversation around the table. How have things changed? How do our seders look different from, let's say, generations past? But another corollary to that is how much has stayed the same? You read through the Gemara that was written 1,500 years ago. You read through the Mishnayos that were written 2,000 years ago. You look through the actual Psukim of the Torah, and there's so much that we still do at our Sedarim that are so similar. Unfortunately, of course, no Karban Pesach. But the writings and the readings and the Minhagim go back centuries and go back millennia even, and that collapses the generations. It means that when I read every year about Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon and Mesubin b'Vnei Brak, and I'm reading about these people, and I'm reading about Yaakov Avinu and his trials and tribulations when he was in Aram and when he was with Lavan, it feels familiar, and these are personalities that I start to know because not only do I read about them, not only do I recite these texts that speak of them, but also because in so many different ways, I'm living my life so similar to the way that they live theirs. Are there differences? Yes. So speak about it. What differences are there? How do we dress differently from the way that they use? How do we imagine that Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah used to dress? What did they used to look like? And how do we look differently? And yet at the same time, what was on their Seder plate? What's on our Seder plate? Are there differences? There are differences. They did not have a Beitzah or a Zeroah. They had other foods, but they did have maror. What kind of lettuce did they use? They probably didn't have horseradish. They probably did have romaine lettuce. What were they using as karpas? They were having four cups of wine. So much is so similar. Our matzahs are brittle and their matzahs were soft. Okay, but there's so much that is similar. And actually speaking about those differences to no small degree, I think this is another important point to highlight. It actually accentuates the similarities. Meaning, if when we, what do we always be? Oh, our matzah, the Ashkenazi matzah, it's so hard and it's so brittle, it's so different. Where do we come up with this mishagas? And why does it have to be? Think about what that says. What it does say is that, you know what? It's just flour and water and has to be baked in 18 minutes. So if the style is slightly different and it's a thorn in our side, yes, at the same time, it really speaks to just how similarly our Siddharim are and how that creates a common language over the course of the generations. That the things that we're reciting now are things that we recited so long ago. What are some of the things that we do? So the very end of the Seder, the very end of Maggid, we say, we speak about how we have to view ourselves as though we personally left. How could we possibly do that? How could we view ourselves as though we left? It's through this. It's through Masorah. So Masorah is something that's very, very present in most years, in many homes, at our actual Seder tables, where you could have three generations, four generations. We'll be privileged this year to have, it's Hashem, four generations, at least for one of our Siddurim, all sitting around the table, which is pretty wild and a remarkable zechus. But there's Masorah right there at the table. And what does that say about being able to connect with generations past, even when there's some lingo and there's some jargon that, you know, the younger generations use that the older don't, and vice versa, and they don't know all the same songs? So much is so similar to the way we practice. The things that are most important to us in our lives really are so similar. Let's highlight those things. Let's think about those things. At Yachatz, there's a minhag, mostly amongst Sfaradim, I think, of taking the matzah and putting it on your back once you break it, as though you're actually leaving Mitzrayim. How do we do that? How do we view ourselves as though we left Mitzrayim? It's through this mechanism. It's through Masorah. Masorah is the collapsing of the generations. It's identifying with even that generation long ago that left Mitzrayim, because I recognize fundamentally I'm not so different from that generation. So much of what I do is still so similar. So many of my mentalities and my attitudes and my role models, my heroes, I still think about Moshe Rabbeinu, and I read the Torah, and I read these parshios, and I read the Haggadah. That is what gives us the ability to actually put ourselves back into their shoes. So I'll mention it now that, again, that some say that Halach Ma'anya is actually a recreation. Think about what we're saying. Halach Ma'anya diachalu avasana ba'ara de Mitzrayim, that this is what our ancestors ate in Mitzrayim. So if we're talking about what they ate in Mitzrayim, so like, who are those people? Who are the people who are actually, who are we supposed to be when we say that paragraph? We're not supposed to be ourselves, seemingly, because we say that if you need the Karban Pesach, come and have the Karban Pesach. So where are we? What generation is that that is meant to be the actual authors of the paragraph of Halach Ma'anya? We're saying that if you need a Karban Pesach, you can come with me and I'll give you your Karban Pesach. Well, if we're talking about a Karban Pesach, we must be in Eretz Yisrael. Or if we're in Eretz Yisrael, then why are we speaking about how Lashana Haba be Yerushalayim, that next year will be B'nai Chor, and next year will be free? What's going on? Some suggest that it's meant to be a recreation of Pesach Mitzrayim itself. That first night, we could speak about this is the bread that our ancestors ate here, because it was the bread that they ate for 210 years while they were working so hard they didn't have time to let their bread rise. And yet we're right now having the Karban Pesach, but we're still not in Eretz Yisrael. We're going to hopefully be in Eretz Yisrael next year. No 40 years, none of that. We're going to just zoom right in. We'll be right there. And we'll be there in just a moment. And we'll traverse the Midbar very easily in just a few days. And we'll be there next year. So we begin the entire Seder. We begin the entire Maggid, Halach Ma'anya, trying to put ourselves back in that place, back in that mind space, back in those shoes. How are we able to do that? It's the notion of Masorah. And it's something important to think about. When we, the conversation of is custom important just for custom's sake alone? The idea of minhag avoseinu biyadinu is a great thing to talk about the second night. Why are we even keeping the second night? What do you need a second night of Yontif for? Why should we bother with the second night? We have the luach, we have the calendar. Why should we have it? So Chazal say, minhag avoseinu biyadinu, because this is what our ancestors did. Our ancestors did it because they weren't sure what day was which. Now, why are we doing it? We're just doing it because certain practices become hallowed by time. Why? Because we're trying to maintain a steady link. We never want to go so far that the way we live our lives cannot be easily identified back with the way that our ancestors lived. When I look around my Shabbos table, I feel on the one hand, thoroughly and wholly American. And yet I look around my Shabbos table and I feel like I could be in the shtetl. I feel like I'm not that different from, you know, from somebody who was living in, was living in Radin, was living in Volozhin, or was living in Spain, or was living in Eretz Yisrael. You come home after shul on Friday night and there are candles burning, we're going to have delicious food, and there are two challahs on the table. Having those trappings that connect us with generations past is what gives us the ability to actually put ourselves back in those shoes and in that mentality, in that mind space, when we want to remember that it's as though we ourselves went out of Mitzrayim. The critical importance of Masorah, certainly worth pointing out. If you do, if you are going to be having a Seder with multiple generations and how meaningful that is to everybody. So just a couple of minutes left. This is really just a Chazar Ashir at this point. The last theme is what I spoke about on Shabbos HaGadol, and it's the reality that Geula takes time. I think this is another really important one to keep talking about. All of the Seder night is about matzah, and it's about how quickly we went out, and it's chipazon, and it all happened in haste, and it all happened in a hurry. Did it really? Did it actually? So, yes, it all happens bishas chipazon, and it all happens in a moment. But what we spoke about last Shabbos was think about the lead up. Think about how much had to happen in order to set the stage so perfectly, building the fire so carefully so that you drop the match, and in that shas chipazon, everything could just explode and combust. That is what chipazon really looks like. There is a buildup so that at some point there can be this transition and things happen. Such an important question to throw around the table. Do we sometimes believe that geula is going to happen all in a moment and all in an instant? And do we actually find that the Haggadah tells a very different story? That it happens in an instant only after the stage has been set for many, many, many weeks, months, years, generations, even centuries. Do we lose patience? Do we lose patience sometimes with Hashem? Do we lose patience sometimes with ourselves? I was expecting more from myself. I thought I'd have arrived by now. I thought I'd be better by now. I thought I'd be rehabilitated by now. I thought I would be redeemed by now, whether from my own doing or from Hashem's doing. And it hasn't happened. Why is it taking so long? We can look at the Haggadah to provide us with a little bit of encouragement that things don't, even when they happen very quickly, there's actually a significant lead up. And I would just add further that even after that Shas Chipazon, even when things have really transitioned very quickly, it still takes a lot of time thereafter to continue to process. So just a number of points. You can really work this into the Seder in many, many different places. Arba Banim, a beautiful idea from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, that the Arba Banim are not only four different sons, they're four different stages of development. The way that he speaks about it, I actually had a Vart a number of years ago that maybe turns this whole thing on its head, but about how you go from being a Sheino Yadei Lishol to a Tam to a Rasha, you get a little, I don't know, maybe that's adolescence or whatever, and then you become a Chacham finally. When you've achieved enough wisdom and enough insight and enough learning, four different stages of life. Rome wasn't built in a day. People weren't built in a day. There are stages of development. Look around the table. It's a great thing to point out, right? Look at the youngest little pitzla. Now look at and I don't know. You want to be careful how you look at the oldest person here, but look at the different generations and the different ages that you have at a table, and recognize that it takes a long time to develop. Things don't happen overnight. It shouldn't surprise us when we're caught in a moment when things are so difficult and we expect things to move very quickly. Look how slowly it takes to actually develop. Look at the different art projects around the table if you still have them. Look, autobiographical. Look, Aliza, you made this. look at this. It's like a little piece of wood. You slapped on some paint and it's a little bit, and this was a few years ago, and Baruch Hashem, you're really advanced. You can do much better work. Look at your Haggadah. Look at your Haggadah from just 3 years ago. Look how beautiful it is now. Your penmanship has gotten better and you're a different Torah, more sophisticated and more insightful. Things take time. It's important actually having some of those, if we have them, some of those tangible representations of, look, we develop over time. The Arba Banim is about how we develop over time. Chachamim weren't created overnight. Perhaps this is why we have the point made of Hare Ani Kaven Shivim Shana. It's interesting. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah in this paragraph, I'm as though a 70-year-old man, right? And we know he wasn't actually 70 years old, but at any rate, he's speaking about himself, Kiyulu at least, as being very aged, and that finally he succeeded. Finally, he succeeded Finally, he succeeded in.
Yosef Bienenfeld.
Oh, Yosef Bienenfeld wrote on the screen. Ah, see, so you say, oh, save it. We're going to save it because in 4 years from now, say, oh, Yosef, look, 4 years ago, you're scribbling on a screen during Tati Shir, and now you're giving the Shir. We're going to save this. We're going to screenshot it. Awesome. Okay. So, Harani Kavenshim Shana, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is talking about a different mitzvah. He's not talking about Sipri Yetzias Mitzrayim. He's talking about the daily commemoration, remembering Yetzias Mitzrayim, Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. So he says, so it's a different mitzvah. Why do we have it here? Why are we talking about it here? I think maybe we'll, let's get rid of this for now. Okay, so why are we talking about this here? Why do we have this now? The reason why we have this now is because the idea, perhaps, that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is saying, you know, my whole life I've been screaming about this. My whole life I've been trying to get everybody to do this. And now finally, Ben Zoma succeeded. Ad Shadarsha Ben Zoma, until Ben Zoma had his drasha. Ben Zoma made his drasha, and then finally everybody followed suit. And now everybody reads all three paragraphs of Shema every single night. It's so interesting. On the one hand, everything changes like that. Chipazon. Once Ben Zoma makes his drasha, gets up in the Beis Medrash, maybe, or maybe because Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was working on it his entire life, maybe because he planted the seeds in the minds of anybody who ever walked into the Beis Medrash, that this is a really important thing I'm working on, that I hope that you'll see it my way. And then finally, there's a breakthrough. Maybe it's specifically because he's pushing, that finally get to a Shas Chipazon. But that Shas Chipazon, that moment of haste, that moment when everything happens automatically in a hurry, that immediate transition, look at it with a grain of salt. Think about how much buildup, how much stage setting is necessary in order to really get there. And then even afterwards, the Hisha Amda, we talk about how it's not only Mitzrayim, it happens again and again and again, even after Geula, even after the Shas Chipazon, even after that moment of haste, when everything goes well and everything's great and everything's extraordinary, what happens? Another ghost, and another enemy, and another enemy, and another enemy, and another Inquisition, and another Chmelnitsky, and another Arafat, and another this, and another that, happens again and again and again. Things take time in order to get to the moment of Geula, and let me tell you, even once you've gotten to that moment of Geula, you know what? There are going to be ups and downs. There are going to be peaks and valleys. Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah and Arami Oved Avi. We go back. We talk about Terach, about how Terach was an idolater. What are we talking about Terach for? Because you need a wide lens on this. We need to go back to Arami Oved Avi. We need to talk about Yaakov Avinu and Lavan, because that's what Jewish history really is. There is a setting of the stage over the course of generations before we can actually achieve what's really achieved at Yetzias Mitzrayim. If what's achieved at Yetzias Mitzrayim is nationhood, Hashem's chosen people, how does that really begin? It begins with Avraham and Terach, that transition from Ovdei Avodah Zarah into finally becoming this actual nation. It takes generations and generations. Things really don't happen overnight. Sometimes they don't even happen in our own lifetimes, let alone within our own lifetimes. We shouldn't expect necessarily immediate success. Eser Makos, I pointed this out last Shabbos. How long did the 10 Makos take? It takes a year. So then after blood and after frogs and after Yekinim and lice, people are saying, I don't know. And I thought we'd be out by now. I can't believe this. Again, even while all these extraordinary things are taking place, we look at it, oh, the Geula's here and Eser Makos and it's all going to be fine. You'd have to imagine that this was difficult to live through on some level. This was a real test of Amunah. Why aren't we out yet? If after every Makkah, Pyro says yes and then no, will we ever get out? It's a real Nisayon. It's a real test of Amunah. But ultimately, they do get out. That moment of haste happens after a year's worth of Makos and negotiating and going back to the palace and pushing Pyro further and further and further. Calculations of the Makos during Kriyas Yamsuf, which can be very difficult to read late at night after, at the end of a long Maggid. But go through all these calculations, talk about Kriyas. Why are we talking about Kriyas Yamsuf? So it's interesting to note the Rambam does not have any of this in his Haggadah, because apparently for the Rambam, this isn't really part of Sipri Tzias Mitzrayim anymore. To talk about Kriyas Yamsuf, to talk about the splitting of the sea, that's not getting out of Mitzrayim, it's not getting out of Egypt, that's not the Exodus, that's not Pesach. Maybe for a different holiday, but really not for right now. What's the point? The point is that even after you experience Geula, for the Rambam, that's what we're celebrating, getting out of Mitzrayim. But the fact of the matter is, we then stood on the banks of the Yamsuf, and things were very, very scary. Final idea, Koshel Eliyahu that we pour at the end. It takes note of the Hevesi, which is not actually one of the four cups. The four cups talk about getting out of Mitzrayim. Hotzesi, Yitzalti, Ga'alti, Lakachti. What's Koshel Eliyahu? We're not sure. Should we have it? Should we not have it? That's the Hevesi. Bring me into Eretz Yisrael, even after getting out of Mitzrayim. That's Geula. We achieved Geula. We've been redeemed. We've been liberated. Everything is great. Hashem, thank you. And yet there's still so much more to come. It's true that redemption can take place b'chipazon. It can take place in great haste. How much is necessary in order to get us there? And even after achieving that benchmark, how much more is there still yet to go? It's a very important conversation to have around the table, that we should take note of this alternate, this parallel narrative of the Seder and of the Haggadah, that things actually do take quite a bit of time. And therefore, even if we find ourselves now waiting,
right? When we in the tefillah that we make for Israel, we speak about Israel as being racist tzmichas gula seinu. It's the first sprouting. We spoke about this from Rav Schwab last Shabbos, that tzemach is the name of Mashiach, tzmicha, the sprouting, is tzemach David Av, that the sprouting of the Yeshua, the sprouting of the salvation, because sprouting and blossoming takes place over time. It's a long and slow process. It doesn't mean it's not happening. And it doesn't mean we're not making great, great progress. And it doesn't mean we're not inching forward in the right direction, personally, nationally, but we shouldn't necessarily believe that it's all supposed to happen overnight. And if it hasn't happened yet, we shouldn't lose hope. Shouldn't lose hope in ourselves. Shouldn't lose hope in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Things will happen. Things continue to go in the right direction. Sometimes they just take a little bit more time than we'd like. Chevra, five different conversations to have over the course of the Seder. Talk about freedom from ourselves, transcending ourselves. True freedom is not just from the externals, but also the internals. Geula as an attitude that we could be experiencing geula and missing it because we're so pessimistic. And we could also be experiencing something less than geula, but still making the most of it, still turning it into as something as close to geula as possible. Again, all attitude dependent. That's something that we see throughout the Seder as well, especially in some of these conflicting kinds of icons, images, and objects of the Seder night. Is it this? Is it that? Is it Geula? Or is it Cheres? Or is it Avdus? Sometimes it's both at the same time, because it's a matter of what we'll focus on. Hashem's hand in history, Hashem's Hashkacha, maintaining our Emuna, and the reality that Hashem is such an active force throughout the Haggadah, throughout Mitzrayim, and obviously beyond. Mesora, the collapsing of generations, idea that we're able to put ourselves back in the shoes of those who left Mitzrayim because our lives are still so similar, and how we act this and how we show this, how we remember that we're really part of that same group who actually left, and we're able to do so because legitimately we are really so similar. And then finally, again, that Geula takes time, even though great transitions happen. B'Shas Chipazon takes a long time to get to that Shas Chipazon, and even after that moment of haste, takes quite a bit of time to continue along the right trajectory. Chevra, Ken, thank you enough for joining. Thanks so much for making the time. Well, it's a very, very busy night. As always, if anybody has any questions, halachic issues that come up, kashering, etc., between now and Pesach, please don't hesitate to reach out. Wishing everybody a chag kasher v'sameach. Thanks very much for joining.